Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and we're starting on Bainbridge Island today.
This is our family farm. It was originally 20 acres and filled with raspberries.
Gina Corpus is standing off New Brooklyn Road on land that's been in her family for two generations. She looks around and sees the history of a whole community.
The Romeros, who lived down the road, there were 12 children. And then up the hill, up New Brooklyn Road, is where the Rapata children grew up, and there were 13 in their family.
Bainbridge is known for its history of Japanese-American farming. But this area around Island Center was dotted with the farms of Filipinos, including Gina's father. She points out a spot just beyond the trees.
That's where our berry pickers from Canada used to stay during the summer when they harvested our fields for us. And we would say to each other, "Let's go play with the Indians." And it's so funny now because we thought we were playing with the Indians, but had not even been told that we were Indians ourselves or indigenous people.
Gina grew up as a Filipina, but all these years later, she identifies differently as an Indipino. The term mixes the words indigenous and Filipino. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is Family Matters. And this is the story of a collection of families who founded a unique culture. It's a group of mixed heritage people whose history is intimately tied to Bainbridge Island. That history began at a particular moment one summer in the strawberry fields. Sound Effect's Posey Gruner has the story.
Walk in the door of the Bainbridge Island Historical Museum, and you'll see a wall of photos. Gina Corpus points to one of them.
My mother and father's wedding photo.
It's a black and white photo of a young couple. They met in the strawberry fields of Bainbridge Island and married in the summer of 1942.
She was only 15, and my father was about 25.
Gina's father, Anacleto, came to Bainbridge first. He was from a farming region in the Philippines, and he'd been recruited, along with many other Filipino men, to come work on the strawberry farms. Her mother, Evelyn, came next. She had spent the past 10 years in Canadian Residential School, a government-sponsored religious school where nuns worked to remove the Indian from the child. She had been recruited, along with many other Indigenous girls just like her, to come pick in the fields.
They came down by the busloads, and their first summer picking for the Japanese-American farmers, they picked alongside young Filipino bachelors. And that year, the first year, there were 13 marriages.
Over the years, there were more marriages between Filipino men and Indigenous women, 35 in all. Later, other Filipino bachelors went back to the Philippines and returned with Filipino wives. And the community grew. It was a time of racial tension on Bainbridge Island. That strawberry summer happened just months after the Japanese-American farmers who owned the fields were rounded up at the dock and shipped away. Gina's father, Anacleto, felt conspicuously Asian. He lived in fear that he would be next. But he found comfort in community. He was one of the co-founders of the Filipino-American Hall, a social club where the community would gather at the end of the week's work.
And the band, my dad and my uncles would get up there and play the bass, and they were all such fabulous dancers, swing dancers, and they'd dance all night. And so it was good in that way, but I still have this feeling that our mothers were really second-class citizens in this Asian-oriented community.
When Evelyn married Anacleto, she was disenrolled from her tribe. She spoke Squamish, a language with steep shifts in inflection and abrupt glottal stops. But in her husband's home, they spoke only English, or Ilocano, his Filipino dialect. In fact, the only time Gina remembers hearing Squamish was when her mother would go out back.
So I called it the outhouse language because that's the only place I ever heard it.
It's one of the few actual memories Gina has of her mother. For a long time, she knew only the most basic details of her life. She gave birth to 6 children, all girls. She was often alone with them. She became an alcoholic. When Gina was 5, her father divorced her mother. A few years later, her mother died. She wasn't remembered fondly.
I remember being driven home from school by one of the Filipinas, and as I was getting out of the car, she said to me, "If your father hadn't married an Indian, you would have a mother now."
Gina grew up. She graduated high school, raised a kid. And as she got closer and closer to age 37, the age her mother died, she started thinking more about her. And that's when she got an important invitation. A neighbor who worked in mental health and multigenerational trauma had been hired by the Squamish Nation to do a healing workshop. She asked Gina to come along.
She said, "Gina, would you like to go to the Squamish Nation and meet your relatives? You have not met them yet. Maybe it's time."
Gina went to the workshop. There were 30 women arranged in a talking circle.
And everybody who spoke cried. And by the time it was my turn, I couldn't speak because I was so emotionally overwrought and drained by the unresolved traumas that I had suffered and that I had inherited from both my parents. And it was the beginning of my healing journey.
Gina went back to school to learn about Indigenous people and to get a master's in education. She took up the spiritual practice of the Sweat Lodge, and she felt called to return to the Squamish Nation to help educate a new generation of children in a culturally sensitive way. It felt like something she needed to do.
And I did not want to go to the spirit world with unfinished business.
About a year ago, Gina joined with her sisters and other Bainbridge Indipinos to start a new organization. It's called the Indipino Community of Bainbridge Island and Vicinity, and one of their most visible projects is on view at the Bainbridge Island Historical Museum. That wall of photos, the one with her parents' wedding photo, it's an exhibit called Honor Thy Mother. It celebrates the 35 women who came to Bainbridge Island that strawberry summer. Katie Curtis from the Historical Society helped with the exhibit, and she was at the opening.
There were tears in people's eyes. There were children who said, you know, pointed and said, "That's my grandmother," you know, or "That's my great-grandmother." And there were teachers that came in and looked at the names and said, "I had these names in my classrooms, and I had no idea about this story."
All of the women are gone now, except one. But Gina thinks they would be proud. Nearly 80 years after they first came to this island, here they are at the Bainbridge Island Historical Museum with their pictures on the wall.
That story from Sound Effects' Posey Gruner. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is Family Matters. Seattle author Paula Becker writes about historical events, like the 1962 Seattle World's Fair. She writes about people, as she did in her book The Egg and I, about the 1950s children's book author Betty McDonald. Her most recent book is about her own family. It's called A House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction. Specifically, it's about raising her oldest child, Hunter, and his struggle with substance use disorder. She spoke with Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing.
Hunter is not alive. He was killed on June 29th in 2017 in Central Point, Oregon. He was 25 years old. He was a passenger on a Greyhound bus, which was taking him to San Francisco. Hunter got off at a rest stop. As he was rushing to get back on the bus, which was pulling away, the driver didn't stop, and Hunter was run over. Paula Becker's book, A House on Stilts, isn't about the tragedy that happened at that rest stop. It's about why Hunter was on that bus in the first place. He was looking for a fresh start in a new city, a place where he might be able to finally overcome his addiction to heroin. It wasn't until after Hunter died that Paula was able to take a step back, appreciate the good times, sit with the bad, and share her story in her book.
And I feel like part of the process of writing this book is I really was able to access again everything, all of his life. You know, the funny stuff, the hard stuff, the goofy stuff, the family jokes, you know, it all, I could have it again without it hurting like it had when he was in addiction.
Is there anything that you want to read from the book at all?
Well, I could read you the description of him when he was little if you wanted.
Sure.
Okay. He was a fearless child. Extremes of every sort delighted him. No dark could ever be too dark. No snow too cold, no story too intense, no bridge or cliff or overlook too high. Hunter began to walk at 9 months, to talk when other children were still pointing. He made us know his fearlessness in words and actions. He'd grin and clench his fists and grrr. "Hunter, you're fierce," Barry and I would say. "Fierce," he'd reply. "Fierce like a dinosaur. Fierce like a shark." I feel blessed in every way to have been his mother, even though the road was really hard.
In the beginning, the life that Paula and her husband, Barry Brown, crafted for their three children was idyllic. Hunter was their first. Then came Sawyer, followed by Lily. Paula put her career on hold to devote time and energy to homeschooling the kids for several years. Barry, a doctor, supported the family. The house was full of books and board games, and they went on a lot of car trips.
Looking back, you know, one weekend we went and camped near Mount Rainier, and then we went to Wenatchee, and we went to Yakima, and we went to the...
For Hunter, Sawyer, and Lily, this was a pretty great way to start out life. Two parents who love each other, a roof over their heads, food on the table, and the resources to go out and explore the world.
It was a very, very thrilling and grounded and safe kind of childhood for them.
When the kids got older, Sawyer and Lily went to elementary school. Hunter enrolled in 7th grade.
And he seemed like he was doing really well.
When Hunter got to high school, cracks started to appear. He didn't join any clubs or play any sports. Instead, he started hanging out with the kids who smoked cigarettes, who did a little more experimenting with alcohol, the kids who were kind of the outcasts. When Paula questioned Hunter's choices of friends, he pushed back.
He was not at all judgmental, and he sort of valued the underdog, even from being a little boy. He would say to me sometimes, "These are not bad people." And I said, "I didn't say they were bad people, but some of the things they're doing look like they're bad for them."
Over the course of high school, as Hunter's behavior became more rebellious, there were plenty of moments of normal family life.
Lots of hanging out, lots of going out for sushi, lots of hugging me, telling me he loved me, but also the sneaking out, the not going to school, the, you know, experimenting with drugs and alcohol. So the mix of this, right? Because it's never just one thing. It's never something where, you know, like a TV movie. It's not.
By the time Hunter was a senior in high school, he was smoking pieces of fentanyl patches in the family's basement. If Paula could wind back the clock and do it again, she says she would have done family therapy instead of dropping Hunter off for his private appointment, which he often skipped out on. If she could do it again, she would have tried to keep Hunter more closely tethered to the family instead of his friends. Paula and Barry did the best they could at the time with the tools they had. So instead of graduating from high school at the end of his senior year, Hunter went to rehab in California. When Paula and Barry went there to visit for Parent Week, they asked the other parents there how many times their loved ones had gone through rehab.
How many times? Oh, 5, 10, 30. We knew we weren't going to be able to send him to rehab 30 times. That was not going to happen.
When Hunter got back home to Seattle, he relapsed and was injecting heroin. Paula and Barry were faced with a choice that no parent wants to have to make. For the safety of the other two kids, Hunter couldn't live in their house anymore. For about 6 months, Hunter was living on the streets of Seattle. Still, Paula and Barry found ways to parent their homeless, addicted 18-year-old son.
And sometimes all that meant was, absolutely, I'll buy you lunch. Do you need mittens? Those socks? You know, sometimes that's as loving as you can be when your kid is going through something as big as heroin addiction. And learning to sit with that fact was the work of my life.
For a brief period of time, Hunter was close by. There was a playhouse in the backyard that Hunter had built with his dad. They called it the House on Stilts. When he was younger, the shelter was where Hunter would hide out with friends and read books. As an addict, it became his home. He started sleeping there.
We decided that that was okay. I would go back there sometimes in the morning and I would just look and wait and watch and see him breathe, you know? And I knew that it was twisted. Now I would buy him food at Safeway. He turned 19 back there and I bought him a slice of coconut cake and stuck it back there with a note. I would have baked him a birthday cake. That was my whole programming. But even I decided you're not going to bake a birthday cake and leave it in what's basically a squat house in your backyard.
For the next several years, Hunter had ups and downs. He had some very good years where he was able to get sober, hold down a job, have a girlfriend, share an apartment. But all of that ended when his girlfriend had her wisdom teeth pulled and Hunter took one of her pain pills.
That was kind of it. It was like one, and then it was the slide back to heroin so quickly.
That slide is eventually how Hunter ended up on the Greyhound bus in 2017. Paula knows that all of this is difficult for people to hear, especially for parents.
I'm the boogeyman, and I understand that. And I think if I had picked up a book like this when my kids were young, I would have immediately put it down because I would have wanted to put my fingers in my ears and say, la, 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 that won't happen to me, that won't happen to me. And hopefully it won't.
Who do you want to read this book?
I really want people who have kids of about 11 and 12 to read this book. The trick is to try not to let the kid tumble over into addiction, right? So when they're experimenting is the time to try every possible way to get them back. And I liken it in the book to, oh, I'm smelling smoke. And I should have said, my God, the house is burning down. But not saying, you know what? I know this kid, this is going to get better. That's not a thing I recommend.
Hunter was a voracious reader. He and Paula often traded books and talked about them. When Hunter died, he left a small bag of belongings on his seat on the bus. Inside were three books that Paula had given her son as gifts: The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and The Life of Pi. Paula hadn't read them, but she thought that her son would enjoy them.
And so in my deep, deep grief, in really even just the days or the weeks following his death, I said to myself, I'm going to read those books. And so I read them, you know, like you would read the Bible or something. I read like a chapter every morning. And, you know, it's like, oh, of course Hunter liked this. And I was so glad to have that, you know, sort of intimacy, you know, reading a book and sharing it. I couldn't talk with him about it, but I could know why he liked them because I was his mom.
Paula has some advice for people who might have a close friend or family member whose child is struggling with active addiction. Paula says that when someone shares this very personal information with you, don't recoil and pull away, as many did with her. She says to make sure you lean into that person. Take a step closer.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. Paula Becker and her husband Barry Brown sued Greyhound for the death of their son Hunter. A jury awarded them $18 million for pain and suffering. Paula says they plan to donate some of the money to the various nonprofits that helped Hunter when he was alive. This is Sound Effect from KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's theme is Family Matters. Who gets to have a family? It may seem like a weird question. Whoever wants to, right? But for people with disabilities, especially intellectual and developmental disabilities, or IDD, that was not always the case. In fact, for generations, many people with IDD were involuntarily sterilized and otherwise prevented from having children. Ivanova Smith was born with intellectual and developmental disabilities. She lives in Tacoma now, but growing up in Soviet-controlled Latvia, kids like her were often warehoused in orphanages. That's where she spent the first 5.5 years of her life.
I would say it was very lonely. Like, everything was the same. And I remember not having anything and not understanding concepts like family or anything like that. We had no holidays, no birthdays. I would just sit there. I remember one time I would just stare at a light and just watch little floaters, those little floaters that you get in your eyes. And that was my entertainment. Oh, I get really scared. I get really like an icky feeling. I'm very fearful of any type of institutionalization because of it. I actually do remember the day I was adopted. And so I remember getting taken out of bed, and there were these two people, and one of them was holding this big machine. Later I learned this was a camcorder, and my dad was taking video of me and meeting me, and that's how I met my new family. I eventually learned English, and I had to speak it stuff because I didn't learn how to speak till I was 5.5. I was babbling. There were times I had a hard time understanding people, and people had a really hard time understanding me. I didn't know how to play with toys. Like when I first got here, my sister gave me a stuffed bear, and I didn't know what to do with it. So I just gave it right back to her. And so my family had to help me learn how to play. And I didn't understand the concept of family for the first 5 years of my life. So, but the grace of God, we got through the hard times and got to the good times. I think when I started seeing other people with IDD going to college, and I really love history, that's my passion is history, and that kind of motivated me and my mom and dad said that they would help me get into university. So Central was very welcoming. Because I was very honest with them, but they had really good disability services there, and so they were very supportive. Yeah, so, you know, I would be at the Central Library, and I found all these books about people with disabilities, and they were made in, like, 1920. And they were books on applied eugenics and how do you apply this stuff. And so eugenics was the science of how do we apply the healthy people breed and the immigrants, the Easterners, the people of other races, people of color, people with disabilities, people with any type of mental condition. Those are people with all bad genes. And they should not be allowed to breed. And I was just like, wow. I mean, these were like the manuals of justification back then. And they were still in our school, university libraries. And so I started researching. I started reading these books. And it was really funny and ironic being, you know, in the 21st century, an IDD student, reading the books of the people who would have had been instituted and sterilized and no life of my own. And for some people, that's still happening to them. And so that's why I'm very passionate about ending these functioning labels. And this mental age theory is, you know, if you're mentally a child, we can take rights from you. That's what they would say. And just because I may need support with certain things, doesn't mean I'm 12. We all should have the right to grow up. I think I would have been put in an institution. I would have never been put in one I could have been adopted out of. I definitely would have been sterilized against my will. I wouldn't have got to live the life I have now. Yeah, so I remember the first time I met Ian. It was one of the first days of youth group. That's in seventh grade, and this was one of my family's attempts to get me friends, because all elementary school I had no friends. So I remember this boy coming up to me, and he sits right by me, and he just starts talking to me about magic cards. And I was like, oh, well, I just learned about magic cards. Then the second time I saw him was at a winter camp. He wooed me with history. He started talking to me about World War II tanks, and I loved history. When we went to separate schools, and so there were a couple of years I didn't tell him that I was a special ed, and he it was not until he started asking me about my Wausau scores, Wausau test, and I was like, uh-oh. I better fess this up. So I told him, and he said, I don't care, you're still the most intelligent woman I know. I was like, okay, thank goodness, because that means you do really love me and you accept me, and so I could be more myself around him. We got married right in 2014, and it was one of the happiest days of my life. A 100 years ago, I would have never been able to have my little girl. Oh, I was scared. I was so scared when I was pregnant. I have the nightmare idea that she was going to be taken from me. Like if I had a meltdown, or if, like in the delivery room, like somebody thinking I'm not safe. I was gonna have my daughter separated from me, and so I tried to do a lot of precautions. And luckily, I had made a lot of connections with parent advocacy organizations, and they helped me kind of, you know, okay, here's the goal. We gotta get you into a safe home. And parenting classes, that was the other thing, gave me into parenting classes and gave me mental health care. I had my whole family and my friends in the delivery room with me most of the time. I think it helped a lot. Sometimes I have emotional outbursts, and I'm always scared of it when it happens in public. I try for it not to happen in public, but sometimes it does, and I'm always scared that that's going to cause something. Somebody tried to call CPS on me, up the police on me. I know that people can misinterpret things. I want her to keep her family. And I want other people to have the right to have this, too. And I hear my little girl.
That little snuggle. Now you'll get to meet her. This is a little snuggle. This is Alexandra. She's so happy. I love her so much, and I just want her to have a good life, and I don't think she would have a good life separated from me. Well, there was this one day that we were just sitting together, and she just was talking to me. And we just had like a little conversation, and she just snuggled and hugged me, and it was just a really happy moment, and then my husband got home from work and he joined in, and we were just a happy little family, and it was just a really happy, intimate, I hope that bring other people happiness too.
Ivanova Smith lives in Tacoma with her daughter and husband. She's a member of the advocate faculty at the University of Washington's program Leadership Education in Neurodevelopmental and Related Disabilities.
Mm-hmm.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this week's theme is Family Matters. As a parent, you worry all the time about your kids. Most of the time, the worst doesn't happen. But, of course, once in a while, it does. Bonnie and Jerry Gibson came face to face with that reality in 2016. And what's unusual about their story is the way they were able to take something senseless and turn it into something constructive. The Gibsons live in Salton, Washington, on the Skykomish River. Jerry's a retired federal worker. Bonnie's a retired nurse. It was a solid middle-class household. But early on, their son, Greg, showed signs of an unorthodox streak.
He was not any, you know, like, you give him a coloring book, he wouldn't color. I mean, he drew his own pictures, you know. He was that kind of a kid, you know. He wasn't interested in doing anything conventional.
Instead of the coloring books, Greg would tape pieces of paper together and draw life-size superheroes. He loved superheroes. And then there was music class, where his sisters were learning piano.
And I could just see from a young age that he had unusual rhythm, which now I go, did I really want those drums in my basement, you know? But it was fun to see a little kid kind of find himself.
Greg did find himself in music. A lot of punk and ska, but anything really. By his teenage years, he was already getting into the business side.
He was actually even doing promotions at that time, which I would get a phone call from somebody in like Chicago or something, and he had somehow they knew his name and they were trying to get to Seattle to do a venue, and I was like, oh my God, you know. High school, you know, 17.
What do you remember about watching him watch music?
Oh, it was, I think, just sheer happiness. I mean, it was like, it made us realize how many people find themselves in music. You know, I don't think I realized that before. I mean, it's just a tremendous factor in a lot of people's lives.
And there's nothing better than old folks watching headbangers dance.
By the time Greg was in his 20s and 30s, he was a busy local promoter, handling the bookings at Tim's Tavern in Seattle, planning shows and benefit concerts. He had a reputation for looking out for the bands, making sure they got paid, even if it meant giving up his own cut. So, yeah, no one was getting rich. For years, Greg had lived in the basement unit of a rundown house in Shoreline.
It was a kind of a punk house. It was a rambler with a basement. And it was, you know, kind of generally unkept. One of the things that held him back is where he was living, he had his dog Nino, and he was totally everything to him. And he was a pit bull, and pit bulls, you know, you can't live in an apartment. So he was kind of locked into living in that kind of a situation.
That had always been okay. Not ideal, but worth it to do what he loved and to be with the pet he cherished. But then on the morning of January 8th, 2016, Jerry and Bonnie got a call from their daughter Colleen. She'd just seen it on Facebook. There had been a fire.
It just, like a 2x4 smacking you. You know, it can't be true. So we immediately head out that way to his house in Shoreline. And, you know, Greg was dead.
Some sad news. An early morning fire in Shoreline has killed a popular music promoter.
Greg Gibson died. Four of his roommates were able to escape the Shoreline home they shared.
Well, there was people standing all over, lots of cars, emergency vehicles, people standing in groups talking, the firemen scurrying around, you know, starting their investigation.
It's a nightmare. He died of smoke inhalation. He couldn't get out.
What probably happened was Nino started barking and then woke Greg up, and then they went to the door. And so Greg was found on top of Nino, and then there was about a foot of clear air in the room, you know, and the rest was dark, thick black smoke. And that's what kills people. I mean, you basically have two breaths of that sort of air and it singes your lungs and, you know, you can't breathe and you die.
For Greg's funeral, Bonnie Gibson says they wanted something that would feel welcoming for Greg's friends. So they steered away from a traditional service and instead invited bands to play and celebrate Greg's life.
It was like everybody that we knew through our whole life was there, you know. It was like being at your own funeral.
I think it was Colleen's idea to get balloons and have people write a note on it. And we all went outside. let the balloons go. And just at that moment, rainbows came out in the sky. Two rainbows, yeah. It was just like it was meant to be, magic. I remember that.
Amidst the grief and the outpouring of love, there was another feeling too. Outrage and an overwhelming compulsion to act.
Well, actually, it started the morning that Greg died when we got to the house. Colleen, our second daughter, was already there. And the first thing she says, there was no smoke alarms, we have to do something. So the idea started right then.
The idea was that no one should live without a smoke alarm and the fighting chance it gives people to survive. Within 2 months, the Gibsons launched a nonprofit, Gibby Home Fire Prevention. They cooked up a logo, Greg with his trademark goatee as a caped superhero. He holds a fire extinguisher with his sidekick Nino beside him in a cape of his own. They partner with the Red Cross to install free smoke alarms in people's homes all over the region.
We have put smoke alarms in million-dollar houses. We put them in trailers. We put them in places where I think I'd rather live in a tent. The whole purpose is we'll save a life.
It's not an easy path they've chosen. They've put themselves in a position where over and over they have to relive what may be the worst thing that's ever happened to them.
I mean, some days it's not hard at all. It's kind of like when I used to go to work and you'd see all these horrible situations, sick people in the hospital and stuff. I mean, it's just your life. But there certainly are those situations that, you know, just bring it up front again. And it's hard.
When they're in someone's home, they don't always talk about their personal connection to this cause. But Bonnie says about half the time, she winds up telling this story. Gibby Home Fire Prevention has installed more than 4,000 smoke alarms in 4 years.
It's helped me with the grieving process, and you're helping somebody else. And it's rewarding to me personally, I think. I'm kind of, you know, the more smoke alarms I can put in, the better I feel.
So Greg Gibson lives on as a superhero. Besides all the smoke detectors installed in his name, in 2019, the state of Washington passed a new law, the Greg Gibby Gibson Fire Home Safety Act. It tightens up requirements for property sellers and landlords to ensure there are working smoke alarms in the homes. And the music community that had always embraced him hasn't forgotten Greg either. Gibby Fest, an annual memorial benefit concert, is now in its fifth year.
Your life story was incomplete.
Bonnie and Jerry Gibson live in Sultan, Washington. You can find more info on their nonprofit at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. This is an original song by his friend Jason Wakeham. It's called Gregarious.
I don't know what else I can do but write a song.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, it's Sound Effect, and today's theme is Family Matters. Of course, not everybody chooses to have kids, and a lot of people say there's a stigma attached to that, that our social norms are built around reproducing. But people without kids are really doing the world a big favor in a way. Fewer people means less pressure on resources and the climate. One former city councilman on Bainbridge Island wanted to celebrate that. He suggested that the city designate the third Sunday in June as I Didn't Reproduce Day. It did not go well. Here's KNKX's Bellamy Palethorpe with the story.
Let's just get this out of the way up front. I am not a mom. I wanted kids at one point, but it didn't work out. So I'm a doting aunt. One of my nicknames is Auntie Belle, and I do have two house cats, my fur babies, but they don't really count. Perhaps that explains a little bit about why I was excited to head out to Bainbridge Vineyards to meet Betsy Wittick, another childless woman. It's raining hard as she gives us a tour of the property, but she wears her parka unzipped and doesn't bother with a hat. Then she welcomes us into a horse stall.
Come in, but just watch this upper one's electrified.
She takes care of a pair of draft horses that she uses to plow most of her fields.
Rich, Abby, come here.
Good girl. She's interested in your microphone.
She wants to taste it. This vineyard sets a high bar for sustainability. These horses and lots of human power replace gas-powered engines. And Betsy grows a lot of her own food.
Betsy is the one who gave City Councilman Ron Peltier the idea for I Didn't Reproduce Day. It came from a sketch done by a late-night TV comedian.
Every once in a while, for entertainment at night, I'll catch a YouTube video, and I happen to come across one from Bill Maher. And so I sent it to Ron, and I think from that idea, he thought, well, this is something we should have more discussion on.
We love Betsy. She's like part of our family.
She kind of got you into trouble, though.
She might argue with me on this.
She played the clip for you, right? The Bill Maher clip?
Yeah, that's one of our favorite things to do is sit around the table. She'll get out her cell phone and play something on YouTube for us, and we loved it.
Now that we've had Mother's Day and Father's Day, let's set aside this Sunday to celebrate people who are neither with a new holiday called I Didn't Reproduce Day.
Maher goes on, singing the praises of condoms and pointing out that all the cool aunts and uncles of this world can be credited for preventing a lot of carbon emissions by not having children.
There's literally nothing you can do that's better for the environment than to not produce another resource-sucking, waste-making human being, probably with a bad attitude.
It's hard to say accurately how much carbon pollution not reproducing saves. A recent study out of Sweden ranked it as by far the best thing you could do to reduce your personal carbon footprint, almost twice as effective as ditching your car. Ron says that point struck a chord with him, but so did the humor.
He really spoke the truth, you know, that single people have been stigmatized for not having children as if they're lesser. I think that's really unfair. And he hit the nail on the head with the impact. And this is something that my wife, Paula, and I have talked about since we got together. And something that's been on my radar screen is just the impact of population. And he's just coming out and saying it. And generally speaking, people don't talk about it.
Ron says he watched the clip a bunch of times. He was thinking about whether he could actually introduce some sort of legislation to take this joke and make it into a reality. So one spring day, he sat down at the desk in his home office and cranked out a proclamation.
A proclamation by the mayor of the city of Bainbridge Island declaring the third Sunday in June as I Didn't Reproduce Day. Whereas human beings are part of a larger community of living creatures and natural systems inhabiting.
We should note here
Earth,
that this legislation doesn't tell people what to do. It's just symbolic, really.
Health and well-being of humans is very much.
It was a rough time for Ron on the council. Earlier that year, he was accused of some ethics violations and ultimately reprimanded for bullying and harassment. He says because of his blunt manners and because of small-town politics. He decided to just serve out his term and not run again. So even though he knew it was unlikely to pass, he hoped the proclamation would at least get a good conversation going. That conversation was captured in a video of the meeting where he asked the council to consider it.
It's not a joke. I'm dead serious. And I don't know how y'all feel about it, but I'd like to request it to be on our business agenda for next week. And we can vote on it.
Then Mayor Cole Medina gestures to a woman on his left.
Councilmember Blossom, you look like you'd like to speak.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly insensitive. I was the only person on this council who's not reproduced. I think it's very insensitive. Some people aren't able to. Some people make a choice not to. But that doesn't mean they're happy with the choice. And it's not a data, it's not something to celebrate. I think it's really insensitive.
Do we need to talk more about it, Councilmember Dietz?
Joe Dietz is the only one to speak up.
I agree with the lack of sensitivity. I don't understand why you did this. I'm not in favor of this at all.
Again, then Mayor Cole Medina.
So I wouldn't support bringing this forward in this way, but I certainly understand the point you're making.
No one supported it. It landed like a ton of bricks. The former mayor, Ron's colleague Cole, who's still on the council, says he really does understand where Ron is coming from with this, but he says the reaction from Councilmember Sarah Blossom was just so out of character that he couldn't move it forward.
And that is extremely unusual for her. On our council, she's probably the least talkative, most reserved person. So for her to react in that way was really just kind of shocking.
I did reach out to now former Councilmember Blossom. She declined to answer any questions for this story. On reflection, Cole says he still agrees with everything in the proclamation, except maybe the title, which he says is too humorous for such a personal and sensitive topic. And Cole says he's annoyed that the government incentivizes people to have children through its tax policy, despite the urgent need for people to consume fewer resources. But he says this one just felt out of place for a small city council.
I think we need to start incentivizing people to think about overpopulation and maybe not have as many children. But it's such a personal decision. You know, it just rubs me the wrong way to think of a government trying to get involved in that personal decision. You know, I guess similar to the way that I don't think the government should be involved in a woman's right to choose when it comes to her own child, right? I mean, it's just such a personal thing.
Another reason his peers may have thought it was a sarcastic joke was that Ron accidentally set the date for this new holiday to fall on the third Sunday in June. That day is taken. It's Father's Day. For the record, Cole, who is also a dad, didn't pick up on that right away either, and Ron insists that he didn't do it on purpose. But he's not sorry.
Well, you know, it's funny. Sometimes things just happen the way they're meant to. And yeah, I got the day wrong. I didn't mean for it to be on Father's Day, but the fact that I did propose it for Father's Day got a lot of attention. It resulted in the Bainbridge Review, which is always looking for something to slam me over. It got them to run an article that then got the attention of Nationwide. I mean, if you go and Google I Didn't Reproduce Day, you'll see Bill Maher, but you'll also see me.
So Ron says, in a way, he achieved his goal. Even though the council fell silent, he got a lot of people talking about all this. He says things like driving an electric car and recycling a lot are good things to do, but they're not going to make this planet livable for the coming generations. He wants people to reject what he calls the philosophy of perpetual growth.
It should be a conscious choice, and it has an impact on other people, has an impact on future generations and other living things that are on the planet.
Well, and I selfishly, because I'm someone who didn't reproduce and definitely had some emotions about it, particularly when I was a bit younger, I think I've moved through that now. But I like the idea of being honored for my role as an aunt and as a not reproducing woman.
Absolutely. You should be honored for that. You made a contribution by mentoring your nieces and your nephews and young people in general, just as Betsy Wittig does.
Betsy says the council wasn't ready for this conversation, but she hopes people will keep talking about it.
It's somewhat of a taboo subject because I think we all feel that each life is sacred. We want to honor that and want to make sure that everyone who's alive on this planet has a right to a healthy, supportive, good experience. But that also means we have to realize that we are on this finite planet, and how far can we push it before everything gets degraded so people can't have that anymore.
Ron says he's taking a break now, but thinking about another run for council in a few years, and that he would consider rewrites to his proclamation if his colleagues were willing to talk about it. Oh, and by the way, Ron will be celebrating Father's Day this year with his adult son.
Bellamy Palethorpe covers the environment for KNKX. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Bellamy Palethorpe, Kari Ploeg, and Lucy Ostrander. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast or tell your smart speaker to play the podcast Sound Effect. We'd love to get your feedback. Find us on Facebook or email soundeffect@knkx.org. And tune in next week for a special presentation of Outsiders, the new podcast on homelessness from KNKX and the Seattle Times. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.